I'll talk about anions in a honeycomb lattice model. It's an exactly soluble model on a two-dimensional lattice. And the model is this. We have a honeycomb lattice, and there is spin 1/2 on each side of the lattice. And there are two types of sides, but both are occupied by spins. And there are also three types of links in the model. Depending on the direction, they're called X links, Y links, and Z links, like that. And for each type of link, we use a different interaction term in the Hamiltonian. For X links, we use sigma X sub J, sigma X sub K. And similarly for Y links and for Z links. And the Hamiltonian is just the sum of all these terms with some coefficients. There are three parameters in the model, J sub X, J sub Y, and J sub Z. The most interesting case, of course, when all these three parameters are equal, but I'll consider them free parameters. Basically, there are two parameters in the model because everything depends on the ratios of these three constants. As I said, the model is exactly solvable. It's kind of surprising for a two-dimensional model. But in this case, it's very easy to understand why it is exactly solvable. It has many integrals of motion like that. If we compose this product of six Pauli matrices for each hexagon, we get an operator that commutes with each term in the Hamiltonian. B sub P commutes with K sub JK. K sub JK is an individual term in the Hamiltonian. And we can also easily understand why the things commute. If we look at the original model, let's take this hexagon and commute it with the operator corresponding to this link. The hexagon has sigma x for this spin. And this link also has sigma x for this spin. So they commute trivially. But you would try to commute the hexagon with the link that belongs to the hexagon itself. Then we'll have two minus signs for the commutation. Let me show you the second picture. Well, I don't remember the original motivation, but this model turns out to be exactly solvable, which is nice. And another nice feature that it has anions as excitations. So I can't tell why I decided to study this model, sorry. So when we commute this link with the hexagon, we have Z and X for the link and X and Z for the hexagon. And we have two minus signs for the commutation relation, and they cancel each other. So there are infinitely many integrals of motion in the model. Of course, by itself, it doesn't guarantee that the model is exactly solvable. But at least we can do the following thing. We can split the Hilbert space of the original system into sectors. For each set of numbers which take values plus 1 and minus 1, these numbers are called V sub 1 through V sub M, we define a subspace by this condition. So this is a common eigenspace of the apparatus B sub P corresponding to this particular set of eigenvalues. This is the condition. Psi belongs to the space if V sub P times psi equals V sub P times psi. And you'll see later that these numbers can be interpreted as having or not having magnetic flux, some kind of magnetic flux through the hexagon. It will be a Z2 magnetic flux, and the model will be solved using a Z2 gauge theory. So we can split the Hilbert space into subspaces and solve the model in each subspace separately. It turns out that in each subspace there are still many degrees of freedom, but these degrees of freedom can be represented as free fermions, and the model can be eventually solved. Now we can count the degrees of freedom. If we have n spins, there are n over 2 hexagons. And so there are that many states left in each gauge sector. We divide the total number of states by the number of sectors. And this means that there are square root of 2 states per vertex. If we fix the values of the integrals of motion. And this suggests that the remaining degrees of freedom are Majorana fermions, because a Majorana fermion is like half of a real fermion. It has entropy one half per qubit, per Majorana mode. And this is a definition of Majorana apparatus. These are Hermitian apparatus with this commutation relation, and they are related to the usual creation and annihilation apparatus by these relations. So if we have a set of creation and annihilation apparatus, we can construct the linear combinations. We can construct the sum and the difference, and call the sum C sub 2m minus 1 and the difference C sub 2m. And the new operators C sub 2m and C sub 2m minus 1 will satisfy this commutation relation. They can be treated on equal basis. There are no creation and annihilation operators for Majorana fermions. They are all equal. Now, here is a summary of the results, or how the model is solved. For each vortex configuration, for each set of numbers, V sub 1 through V sub n over 2, we compute the energy of the fermionic vacuum. And this is the energy. It turns out by numerical calculations that the energy is minimal when there are no vortices, when all these parameters are plus ones. So all the integrals of motions have value plus one. And this is true for any combination of the model parameters. But depending on the combination of the model parameters, one can distinguish two phases in the model. This is the phase diagram for the model. The phase diagram is written, well, it's represented as a section of the quadrant in free space, or an octant in free space, and the vertices of these triangles correspond to the cases where one coupling constant is big and the other two are small. And in this case, near each vortex, there is a gapped phase. It's called B. And there is also a gapless phase in the middle. It's called A. I'll show you later how to construct this phase diagram. And the gapless phase has a billion anions as excitations. Sorry, the gapped phase, phase B. The gapless phase has some excitations that are ferments, but we cannot classify other kinds of excitations. I mean vortices. There are ferments and vortices. We cannot classify vortices using the usual terminology. The vortices cannot be assigned a definite statistics. But when we apply a magnetic field, the phase becomes gapped, and the new phase in the magnetic field has fermions and vortices that are non-abelian anions.
What do you mean by magnetic field?
Magnetic field means adding a term that interacts, a linear term in each spin, like sigma x times h sub x, sigma y times h sub y, and sigma z times h sub z. And there are three parameters, h sub x, h sub y, and h sub z. Okay, now I'll tell you how to solve the model exactly. The solution is based on a fermionization procedure that is a bit similar to the Jordan-Wigner transformation, but it works in two dimensions. Basically, we will replace each spin by four Majorana fermions, and this will be the set of four Majorana fermions represented by dots. And the model is such that the interaction in terms of Majorana fermions has a special form. The interaction involves the product of four Majorana operators along this line. And along each line in this figure. And the nice thing is that this operator enters only one term in the Hamiltonian, and this operator too. So we can split off this product, and we can assign it a number, because this product commutes with everything else. And then we'll assign a number to each link. It will be like a gauge field. And the remaining degrees of freedom that are shared between different terms in the centers of these circles. So there are Majorana fermions, one per site, that interacts with the gauge field, and they move from one, they can hop from one point to another. And this is the scheme of my procedure. Now, the procedure itself is this. We represent each spin by four Majorana fermions. Or we can say we represent a spin by two fermionic modes. But there is a little problem. If we have two fermionic modes, there are four states, and a spin has only two states. So we need to impose some constraint. And the constraint is that there is an even number of particles in these two boxes. So either both boxes are empty or both boxes are occupied. And this state with one particle is not allowed. So there are only these states, 0, 0, and 1, 1. Using the creation and annihilation operators for the boxes, we introduce four Majorana operators, C, B sub Y, B sub X, and B sub Z. They can be treated on equal basis because they have symmetric commutation relations. The constraint takes this form. The product of the four Majorana operators equals 1. It equals 1 on some subspace, which is the subspace that represents a spin. Spin up is represented, well, it's not exactly that spin up is represented by this and spin down is represented by that. The exact representation is different. Here is one spin of four Majorana apparatus. This is a so-called stabilized apparatus, the apparatus that is used in the constraint. And the spin is represented using this equation. Each Pauli matrices is represented as this product for alpha equal to x, y, or z. So this apparatus commutes with the constraint, which is necessary, of course, for this procedure to work. And the product of the three Pauli matrices equals I times D. D is the constraint operator. But the constraint operator equals 1 on the interesting subspace, on the subspace that represents the spin. So the product of the four Pauli matrices is I, as it should be. And now we found a representation of a spin by four Majorana apparatus, and we can transform any spin operator into a Majorana operator. If we have a Hamiltonian that is written in terms of the Pauli matrices, we can just make this substitution, and we get a new Hamiltonian that is written in terms of Majorana apparatus. And the new operator is equivalent to the old one if we impose the constraint. Okay. The procedure I've just shown you works for any Hamiltonian, but it's not always useful. For this specific Hamiltonian, it is useful because of the special structure of the Hamiltonian. Now, each term in the Hamiltonian, each term k sub jk, becomes this. We just make the substitution, and we regroup the factors. We regroup them like that. We take the product of two b's and call it u. U is inside, and c sub k and c sub j are left separate. This u will be a conserved quantity now. We can assign u sub jk a value which is either plus 1 or minus 1. And after making this assignment, we get a quadratic Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian is already quadratic in c sub j and c sub k. But this operator, or this matrix A sub jk, is originally an operator because it involves the operator u. Now we make the assignment for the u, and we get just the quadratic Hamiltonian in terms of c's. And we know that any quadratic Hamiltonian can be solved. U's commute with the Hamiltonian. Yeah, they do. Unfortunately, they do not commute with the constraints. So we need to take special care of this fact, of the constraints. We need to find a solution for this Hamiltonian and then symmetrize over the constraints. Okay, here is a more detailed description of the procedure. The old integrals of motion corresponding to hexagons are just the product of use of the boundary of the hexagon. So it's like a magnetic field. Each U takes values plus 1 or minus 1. So we can treat U as a gauge field, as a Z2 gauge field. And B will be the magnetic field corresponding to this gauge field. If B equals plus 1, we say that there is no field. If B equals minus 1, we say there is a vortex sitting at this hexagon. So the procedure for the solution of the model is this. We choose a vertex configuration. We choose a set of VSEP. Then for each set of VSEP, we know the magnetic field. We don't know the vector potential itself. The vector potential is U. But we can fix a gauge. We can find a set of values for U that satisfy this equation. After fixing the gauge, we solve for the ground state of the Hamiltonian. We solve for the ground state of the quadratic Hamiltonian in terms of C's. Then we can compute the ground state energy, and it will depend on the vortex configuration. It will depend on whether the vortices are present or not at particular sites, at particular hexagon, sorry. Then we symmetrize over gauge transformations to satisfy the constraints. And of course, the symmetrization procedure does not change these. So now it should be clear that the model is solvable, at least in principle, and I'll go through the details of the solution. Here is just a reminder how to compute the spectrum of a quadratic Hamiltonian. We have a Hamiltonian like that in terms of Majorana apparatus, and to compute the spectrum, we reduce it to a canonical form. The canonical form is special in that all the Majorana apparatus are broken into pairs. Each pair B sub m prime and B sub m double prime will correspond to a normal mode. So these are the normal modes, and there are some energies associated to these normal modes. And the transformation from C's to B's is done by a matrix W. W is an orthogonal matrix. And this is the new matrix after the transformation. And the ground state is just the sum of the integers for the normal modes. And if we have a lattice, we can use the translational invariance, and the spectrum will depend on the momentum. There'll be some function epsilon of Q, and we can compute it. Now, for our model, we have a lattice with two sides per unit cell. So we need to use this representation of the Hamiltonian. The matrix is indexed by J, which now represents the cell number. And the index alpha represents a particular site in the unit cell. Alpha takes values 1 and 2. So the Majorana apparatus are indexed by two indices, and the matrix is indexed by four indices. We do the Fourier transform with respect to this first index. And we get a Hamiltonian that is a 2x2 matrix for each value of the momentum. For each Q, we have a 2x2 matrix. The 2x2 matrix is of this form, where f of Q is this function. It depends on Q. The momentum space, of course, is a torus. And in general, there are two situations, there are two possibilities for this function. This function can either have two zeros in the Brillouin zone for some values of Q star and minus Q star, or it can have no zeros. It turns out that if the coupling constants satisfy the triangle equation, if each coupling constant is smaller than the sum of the other two, Then there are two zeros. And at the zeros, we have conic singularities in the spectrum. Otherwise, if one of the coupling constants is much bigger than the others, there'll be no zeros in the spectrum. The situation where there are two zeros in the spectrum is similar to the spectrum of graphite. It's also a honeycomb lattice, and the spectrum is very similar. Let me now discuss excitations in each of these two cases. First, let's assume that J sub z is large and the other two coupling constants are small. So we are near the corner of the phase diagram. And in this case, there are no zeros in the spectrum. The spectrum is gapped. Now, there is an easy way to understand the properties of this model. We can use the perturbation theory. We have spins that are strongly coupled in the vertical direction, and they form some sort of effective spins. This pair can be treated as just one spin with two states. Either both spins are up or both spins are down. This will correspond to the effective spin up and the effective spin down. And we can write an effective Hamiltonian in terms of the effective spin, the effective spins. To write the effective Hamiltonian, we need to use perturbation theory. In the first order and in the second order of the perturbation theory, nothing interesting happens. The first non-trivial effect appears in the fourth order of the perturbation theory. In the fourth order of the perturbation theory, we get this effective Hamiltonian. It's just the sum of the old integrals of motion, B sub P, but now we need to represent them in terms of the effective Hamiltonian, in terms of the effective spins. So B sub P is the product of six real spins, but now we can represent it like that. It will be the product of four effective spins. Well, of course, it needs to be checked, but it's true that B sub P can be represented as the product of four effective spins. So we can write an equivalent model. Now we have a square lattice, and there will be one effective spin located at one edge of this lattice. At each edge, there is an effective spin, and they interact. They interact around plaquettes and around sites of the new lattice. And if we rename the Pauli matrices like that, we need to do some transformation, some spin rotation for the effective spins. And now we get a model that looks familiar. We have products of sigma z around plaquettes and products of sigma x around vertices. And this model has been solved exactly. It's a very simple model. It has no dynamics. All excitations in this model are static. But the excitations have topological properties. And some of the excitations can be called magnetic vortices, other can be called electric charges. This model is solved in this paper. So magnetic vortices live on plaquettes and electric charges live on vertices. Here are the fusion rules for the excitations. As I said, there are magnetic vortices and electric charges, and there are a total of four super selection sectors. By super selection sector, I mean an equivalence class of particles that can be transformed one to another by local operations. For instance, if we have two electric charges, this corresponds to the vacuum sector because they can be annihilated. But if we have just one electric charge, this corresponds to a new superselection sectors. There are four superselection sectors. The epsilon is the fermion that corresponds to the fermion in the fermionization procedure, but it can be also constructed of a magnetic vortex and an electric charge. And these are the fusion rules. It would take an electric charge and a magnetic charge, we get an epsilon particle. And these are the braiding rules. If we move an electric charge around a vortex, we get the phase minus one. The system will pick up this phase, and it's similar to the Aronoff-Bohm effect, but now it's a gauge magnetic charge and a gauge electric charge corresponding to the Z2 gauge field. It's not a usual magnetic or electric charge. Okay, that's all about the gapped phase. The gapped phase is not so interesting because the excitations are abelian in it. But the gapless phase is more interesting. First of all, we need to study what happens to the gapped phase, to the gapless phase when we apply a magnetic field. This is the new Hamiltonian, which includes interaction with the magnetic field. And the magnetic field is assumed to be small, so that we can use the perturbation theory. If we do the perturbation theory up to the third order, we get this term, which contains the product of the three components of the magnetic field, H sub X, H sub Y, times H sub Z, times the product of three Pauli matrices located on these sides. For each set of three sides configured like that, we have a term like that. And this term translates to a quadratic term for the Majorana apparatus. So in the third order of the perturbation theory, we can reduce the original spin model to free Majorana fermions still. The fermions are still free, but the spectrum is different now. This is the matrix corresponding to the spectrum. We need to find the eigenvalues of this matrix to find the spectrum as a function of Q. And we see that the conic singularity in the spectrum is deformed into a spectrum corresponding to a massive Dirac particle. We can try to write down an effective Hamiltonian corresponding to just one gauge sector. The spectrum is gapless for fermions, but it's gapped with respect to introducing vortices. So we can consider a subspace in the full Hilbert space which corresponds to no vortices, and it will be separated by a gap from the rest of the Hilbert space. And we can write down an effective Hamiltonian for this subspace. And then we only take terms that involve a neighborhood of the zero point of the spectrum that involves only soft modes for the fermions. And we only do it up to the second order. It turns out that due to the small phase volume, all the higher orders are small compared to the first non-vanishing term, which is the second order. Okay. Does that answer your question? Okay. Now, let me discuss excitations that occur in the new phase. The new phase with the magnetic field is gapped. Actually, it's rather difficult analysis to figure out the properties of these excitations. So I'll only tell you the results. There are three superselection sectors now, one, epsilon, and sigma. And they're called so because they're similar to the fields in the Eisen model. And they have the same fusion rules and braiding rules. So this is the vacuum sector, the fermion, and a vortex. Now there is only one type of vortex. The product of two fermions is one. And the product of two vortices is 1 plus epsilon, like in the Eisen model. What does this mean for our model? Okay, suppose we take two vortices, sigma and sigma. And these two vortices are located far apart from each other. If we consider these two vortices as one big object, this object can be assigned charge 1 or charge epsilon. So the Hilbert space for this object is actually two Hilbert spaces, one for charge 1 and one for epsilon. And if there is a charge epsilon, it means that there is another charge epsilon somewhere in the system, maybe far away, that compensates this epsilon charge. But until we fuse these two particles or bring them close together, we don't know which sector we're in, whether we're here or there. The system hides this information, and this information is not accessible to local perturbations of the system. So if these two particles are far apart, there is some hidden information which is well protected from any kind of local perturbation. If we bring these two particles close and eventually fuse them into a single particle, the information will appear as the fusion outcome. The particles either annihilate or they fuse into an epsilon particle. And this is very important for applications, at least for the application I have in mind, to use this system as a quantum memory for a quantum computer. So this is the interpretation of the fusion rules. Now, let's talk about braiding rules. Suppose we have two particles, and we move one particle around each other, or we swap the two particles like that. What will happen then? It turns out that the swap can be expressed as this operator. This is some phase, which is actually 3 pi over 8. I wrote it was unknown, but now it's known. There is also a non-trivial operator that is built of two W operators. What are the W operators? It turns out that to describe this system, we can use Majorana fermions, effective Majorana fermions for each vortex. The non-abelian nature of the vortices can be represented by Majorana operators attached to each vortex. And if the overall state of the system is 1, it means that the state satisfies this condition. The product of the two Majorana operators assigned to the vortices acts like that. And if the state is epsilon, we have a minus sign here instead of the plus sign in this case. When we swap the particles, we act on the system by this operator that is built from the Majorana operators. And this operator is such that it also swaps W1 and W2 up to plus or minus sign. And it's interesting that there is a parameter nu in this formula. And the parameter nu is the sign of this product, sigma, it's the sign of H sub X times H sub Y times H sub Z. These are the magnetic field components. So the magnetic field should not be aligned to the axis. Otherwise, the effect is trivial. There will be no gap. If the magnetic field has some random direction, then there will be a gap. Now let me discuss some applications of this model. I want to use this model or similar models to build a quantum computer. Of course, this model is rather exotic, but it has some nice feature that can be present in more realistic models. More realistic models are usually not exactly solvable, so they're hard to study. This model has the advantage of being exactly solvable, but the presence of anions is a robust property. It's not related to the symmetries of the model. If we introduce some small perturbation to the Hamiltonian, the anions will still remain, if the perturbation is small enough, of course. So we can think of anions as some kind of robust phenomenon, though it's rather rare, but it's robust to small perturbations. Okay. Oh, well, suppose we add a Heisenberg term with a small coefficient. That will be a perturbation. Or distortion of the lattice. You mean?
Suppose your honeycomb lattice is not perfectly honeycomb, but there are some slight bonds. Some bonds are just slightly larger and slightly smaller. So it's not perfectly.
Oh, actually, that's even simpler because the model is still exactly solvable in this case. The Fermionization procedure leads to a quadratic Hamiltonian. If we introduce a Heisenberg exchange, the model will not be exactly solvable anymore, but the anions will persist.
So even if
we're
not a regular honeycomb lattice, yeah, random bond length, all of this will still persist. I mean, there might just be some modification of
the
spectrum.
Yeah, right.
If you will apply the perturbation to some state with a certain number of anions, will it mix it in a state with different number of anions, or this perturbation will keep the number constant, or what would we consider all this
themselves? Okay, a small perturbation doesn't change the classification of particles. Of course, one should be careful when talking about this gapless phase, because the gapless phase itself is sensitive to small perturbations. The perturbation must be smaller than the gap introduced by the magnetic field. Okay. Now, if we introduce the perturbation, the properties of the particles change a little bit in the following sense. Without the perturbation, vortices in the model are static. They have infinite mass. With the perturbation, the vortices will have some finite mass. They will move. But otherwise, their properties will be similar. It means that if we manage to hold two vertices at some places separated by a large distance, the vertices are far apart, there is still a hidden state, a protected state. Of course, now we really need to hold the vertices by some external potential, otherwise they will escape and they can meet at some place on the lattice. But otherwise everything is similar.
I ask a simple question. Anions are exact excitations in the exactly solvable model. When you apply perturbation, do they take finite lifetime or it's legitimate question?
Oh, they will have infinite lifetime.
Still have.
Yeah, yeah. A single anion will not decay.
But two anions, can they meet the...
They can. They can annihilate in the original model too. But in the original model, it's hard for them to annihilate because they don't move. The fermions move, but the vortices don't move. Okay. This is some discussion of a quantum computing application. We represent a qubit by four Majorana operators, by four vortices. The logical zero is built like that. We create two pairs of vortices from the vacuum. And that's it. The logical one is represented like that. First, we create a pair of epsilon particles from the vacuum, and then we split each epsilon particle into two vortices. And we have a new state that is orthogonal to the old state. And we need to trap these four vortices by some impurities, or by potential wells, and keep them far apart. Here is a thought experiment corresponding to a simple quantum circuit. We create two pairs of vortices like that and annihilate them in a different manner, like that. And with probability 1/2, we get nothing. With probability 1/2, we get two remnant fermions. And more generally, we can think about these basic computational operations. To initialize a qubit, we create a pair of vortices from the vacuum. To measure a qubit, whether it's in state 1 or epsilon, or in state logical 0 or logical 1, we fuse the vortices. And to implement a unitary gate, we swap the vortices. And this will be this unitary gate with two different phase vectors corresponding to the two different basis vectors. Unfortunately, these unitary gates, I call them Braden gates, are not universal. They do not allow to perform an arbitrary quantum computation. So these models by themselves do not solve the decoherence problem in quantum computation. But they can solve the decoherence problem for the quantum memory. The anions can be used to realize a robust quantum memory. If we keep the anions far apart, the quantum state will stay potentially forever in the system. So that's it. Thank you for your attention.
Although
it's a phase, it's different. It's a phase in a different basis if we use this particle and a third particle. So this fact by itself doesn't mean that it's not universal. It turns out that this particular gate, if we apply it to different pairs of fermions, doesn't give you anything. it only gives you a small subset of all possible unitary operations. It comes from a mathematical analysis. Yeah, just a moment. On the honeycomb lattice, we use a very special Hamiltonian with different exchange terms for each type of links. And it turns out that this model has integrals of motion.
So, for example, on a lattice like the Kagame lattice,
on the Kagame lattice, we have four neighbors for each side, and we cannot assign three Pauli matrices to the four neighbors.
Oh, I see. But one could expand it.
Yeah, if it's a. I haven't thought about that, but maybe you can generalize it.
What about non-zero temperature?
Non-zero temperature. At non-zero temperature, if the temperature is comparable to the gap, there will be some equilibrium density of anions. And the system will not be good for quantum computation, of course, but if the temperature is low, the density of free anions will be exponentially small, and it can be neglected.
Can you please explain the process that describes the second fusion rule in the case that there is no union?
The second fusion rule. Let me find this slide. Just a moment. You mean this rule? Oh. This one. Well, it's just this. If we have a vortex and a fermion, the vortex can absorb the fermion. And this rule corresponds to applying the corresponding Majorana operators on the vortex. Applying the Majorana operator W sub 1 means that this vortex emits a fermion or absorbs a fermion. Does it make sense to you? Okay. Okay.
Do you have models which are not much more complicated for which you can solve and which do have a universal
unfortunately, I don't know any such model. I mean, there are models that are really complicated that have a universal behavior, but not simple models like that.
Those really complicated ones, are they defined on a lattice with spin operators?
Yeah, they're defined on a lattice with spin operators that involve many spins, like six spins simultaneously.
Thanks. Thanks.